Blog Talk Radio.
The Rebecca Roth Show, where the light shines out of the darkness onto the elephant in the room.
Well, hello, hello. Who can believe that another Saturday has arrived and we're ready to start the Rebecca Roth Show? I'm Ramjet, your host, and we're looking everywhere for Rebecca Roth.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
And with that, I give you Miss Rebecca Roth.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to join you, Ramjet, on these beautiful Saturday mornings where we're dissecting the phone calls of 9/11. It's just hard for me to believe, really, that after 15 years, it'll be 15 years, I'm feeling like we're pushing into the John F. Kennedy conspiracy thing now with 9/11. But I have uncovered some pretty fascinating things, and I guess the reason I have is that I had a 30-year airline career and I was able to see things that were wrong. So what we're going to do, if you haven't listened to our previous shows, they're on YouTube and on Blog Talk.
Well, we've had a lot of great response on the last couple of shows where we talked about the phone calls on the flights that came out of Boston. And so we thought we would continue this. And today we're going to talk about Flight 77, the infamous flight that supposedly flew into the Pentagon, and the phone calls that came off of that. And I'm anxious for this because this is the Barbara Olson story, and nothing's weirder than the Barbara Olson story.
Well, that's for sure. I have to say again, you know, I'm not a conspiracy nut. I'm nutty sometimes, but usually only over the holidays. I just never really thought about this. My first time through, really up until I discovered how the planes were remotely taken, commandeered, and where they all four were landed at the same place. I can always tell when people haven't read my books, when they send me an email and ask me questions that I'm like, you know, if you read the books, you would know all of these answers. So what I discovered, when I discovered that the phone calls, keep in mind, cell phones absolutely did not work above much more than roughly 1,500 to 1,800 feet. We're not talking about something cruise altitude of 37,000 to 39,000 feet, like on 9/11.
Now, 1,500 feet, that's about where a plane is when it gets to the end of the runway.
That's right. It only takes you a matter of seconds to get that high, so you're not going to be there very long. And same thing with descending. And, you know, I get emails from a lot of people that are still trying to use their cell phones, and we have a lot better technology 15 years later than we had in 2001. So one of the things when I started to look at the anomalies as a flight attendant, purser, someone who'd been on the plane, I tested my cell phone many, many times, that I started to look at the anomalies and wondered why nobody was following FAA set in stone hijack protocols, the common strategy. So we have these shows that we started several weeks ago. We did one about the common strategy, and that was the FAA hijack protocols that were in place at the time of 9/11. We get briefed and trained on those hijacking protocols. Every flight attendant every single year has to recertify to be legal to fly as a flight attendant or purser with the FAA, and you have to attend a schooling. And each airline puts on their own schooling, but it's an FAA protocol set basic training. And you review your first aid. If you've got new items like the defibrillators, we got the AED units on board, or if they change our medical kits, or they change the type of fire extinguisher. I mean, we go through everything, first aid and hijack protocols and all that.
So just to be clear, each airline may have some different things that are pertain or germane to their particular airline, but from the FAA standpoint, every single flight attendant is going to get a basic course in certain things. Hijacking is one of them.
Exactly. It's mandatory, and everyone upon training, when they pin your wings on you, you are assigned a month, January through December, and that month you need to have your recertification done sometime between the 1st and the 30th. And anything short of, you know, just giving birth or having major surgery or something, I mean, it's very difficult to even change your month because it's set up year by year to recertify. And it's all logged with the FAA. So, and the training steps basically the same. The airlines might have used a different terminology. You know, after I wrote the first book, The Methodical Illusion, is when I found out that American Airlines, in fact, did have the flight termination remote control system on, only they referred to it, they called it the flight, the flight interruption system, And so, you know, some pilots don't know they have it. And since 2001, in 2006, I believe, George W. Bush made it mandatory. And at that time, around that time, Boeing came out with their own version of a remote control system. It is now mandatory that every airplane flying in United States carriers has a remote control system installed, whether it's the SPC Corporation's flight termination system, which most of the planes had on 9/11, or it's one from Boeing, the uninterruptible autopilot system or something.
Well, the question I've always had is, when those flight interruption or flight termination systems go into effect, who is it that's actually flying the airplane? And what you're saying really is, if Boeing now has mandated that, and so that every Boeing aircraft comes out with their system on it, then wouldn't it be somebody logically from Boeing that's flying those airplanes? And I'm thinking MH370.
Yeah, everyone thinks MH370 now. People are starting to wake up all over. And that's the first thing I thought, of course. By then, you know, my book had been out. I'd done thousands of hours of research. And when that airplane went missing, I went, no, it didn't disappear. It's somewhere. Not only, well, first off, let me answer your question. There originally was a DARPA program called Operation Home Run. We, on the outside here, those of us, even the inside airline people, we weren't supposed to know about it, but it actually got in the hands of Rabbi Dov Zakheim, the CEO of, or someone through him, the CEO of SPC Corporation, and they came up with the flight termination system. And DARPA was doing this around, I believe, the late 70s, early 80s, and it was a black project called Operation Home Run. I think you can find, if you Google search it, you can probably find some information on it now, like everything else. But at that point, that was a system that can be taken over. See, the flight termination system, the flight termination system is actually controlled by units on the ground. Very much, if you've ever looked into how we fly our drones, the flight termination system is what we use. That's what's inside the drone aircraft that we use that are flying in Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan, and all over, just hunting down wedding parties, you know, and grade schools. So that's the same system. So it's actually if you go to the SPC Corporation's website, you can actually see the control modules. And lo and behold, if they have them mobile, so you can actually run 8 aircraft. So we're lucky we only had 4 on 9/11, because there was, I think I found 2 others that somehow the remote control system didn't work, didn't take over. Maybe the perpetrators on the ground handling this screwed up. Maybe they just had a computer glitch that didn't grab onto them. But there are 2 other aircraft, the Secret Service called CNN that day and reported that an aircraft, commercial aircraft, they thought, had flown into Camp David. Nothing ever happened anywhere near Camp David that day. But that I think I figured out which airplane that might have supposed to have been, that they might have supposed to have claimed was crashed. And also one was supposedly going to make it look like it went into the Sears Tower. And even we talked about this last week on United 175, Peter Hansen, the passenger on the right side of the aircraft with his wife and child traveling, who couldn't recognize the Statue of Liberty, Hudson River in Manhattan when he was at 5,000 feet, and thought they, he said he thought the hijackers, I don't know why, because they barely could speak English. I don't know why he would think that other than the fact that he worked for a large military contractor, and he knew the scenario. But he thought the hijackers were going to take them to Chicago and fly them into a building. And this was about 2 minutes before supposedly United 175 supposedly went into the South Tower.
Or more than likely he was being told what to say
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
on a cue card or a rehearsed or something along those lines.
Because
he wouldn't have known that information.
No, there's no way when he was at row 31, which is near the very back of the aircraft. They might have had five or six rows, and it depends upon how many seats the airline crams on there, but you know, I'd say half a dozen seats, maybe, give or take. So he's near the aft end of the aircraft. No hijacker's going to go back there and tell some guy that's traveling with his wife and child what they're intending to do. There's just no way he would have had any idea. Now, what's really interesting about that, United 175, is we have an eyewitness with a sworn affidavit that saw it right after it fell off radar, right after the flight control system took over and was remotely taken up to be landed. Now, so we've got these two, we've got several eyewitnesses that saw United 175 and American Flight 77 landing in Westover. So that's kind of interesting.
Well, let's get to Flight 77.
Okay,
because
we're talking
about
Flight 77,
it.
And we just talked about that. We do have an eyewitness that saw American Airlines Flight 77 in Western Massachusetts.
Well, why don't you give us a kind of a rundown of where Flight 77 took off from and where it was supposed to go and where it got diverted and went into Westover and the timing on that, because
okay.
That's always helpful.
Well, you remember, this is really the one, the first two planes, American 11 and United 175, left from Boston's Logan. So they were really short to get to short time flight time to get to this Air Force base where they were taken. Flight 77 left from Washington's Dulles International Airport, and they left at about 8:20. The flight time is roughly 50 minutes to get up to Westover. The phone call started at exactly the right time to get them basically into probably one of the hangars before they started making phone calls. Now, the thing that's really interesting to me about this, again, how the last two flights had two people. Flight 11 from American Airlines, the first plane, had two flight attendants, Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney. They both called out from that supposed plane using cell phones, we were told, at roughly the same time or within probably 30 seconds of each other. On Flight 175 United, we had two gentlemen, Brian Sweeney, who was a radar specialist, military pilot, who couldn't figure out he was looking at Newark International Airport at 5,000-foot elevation, thought they were over Ohio, called his mother, couldn't call someone that he maybe might have a number that might help, but he called his mommy. And that, when I finally started to wake up, went, uh-oh, this is the Flight 175 that I realized that some of the perpetrators were making the phone calls to. And these are people who went along with this. I don't know whether they're still alive or not. There's no way of me knowing unless they contact me through email. Because, oh God, who knows? But what was really weird is that coincidentally, we had two flight attendants on the first flight. We had two passengers on the second flight. And on the third flight, what do you think we have? A passenger and a flight attendant. One of each. All right. So it's looking like a little pattern set up here to me. And so when I started to look at this stuff, I'm thinking, well, this is really weird. We've got, on United 175, we've got two gentlemen that should know where they're at, that are, one, claiming they're on their way to Chicago. 5,000 feet, mind you, is on your final descent. And just so you know, if you've flown, When the little chime goes off and we say, ladies and gentlemen, please discontinue the use of all electronic devices, turn them off and keep them turned off until you're well inside the passenger terminal. We will be in our, you know, beginning our final descent shortly. We will begin our final descent. That means you're going to be on the ground shortly. That is at 10,000 feet when you get that chime and they tell you to turn your computer and your phone off. Okay? These guys were at 5,000 feet, half the distance, looking at the Statue of Liberty, the Hudson River, Newark International Airport, which is huge, by the way, and it's unlike any others, and they didn't know where they were. And both of them were well-traveled. And one of them was even a pilot. So I said, uh-oh. Wait a minute. And as I started going through this and I stopped, I pulled my emotions out. When I first got into looking at this, I thought, oh, my God, Barbara Olson, TV lady. Well, what a perfect person to have on board to tell you, the only person on the entire 9/11 event to tell you the weapon that they used was a box cutters and knives, and that's from Barbara Olson. So she was on TV, and she was kind of a commentator. So we would believe her now, wouldn't we? And that's what they thought. And I did. Originally, I sucked into all of it, too. Go ahead.
Well, more importantly, I think the fact that she was married to Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General. I mean, if anything was built in to give you certitude to this, this was it. I mean, what are the chances that this would be the way this actually played out? Zero. But to have Barbara Olson, TV commentator, a face and a voice that people knew and trusted, and then being married to the Solicitor General, I mean, you know, that's just pushing the envelope just a little too far.
Well, it is, isn't it? And, you know, like I said, when I first went through it and I wrote Methodical Illusion, I didn't really think this, but I had so many people contact me that said, what about Barbara Olson? And so I started digging into not just Barbara, but all these other people making the phone calls, and they were also on board as passengers. One of the things that I failed to mention, because there was no phone call made by her, but on United 175, we also had an Israeli Defense Forces person who was working for a defense contracting company visiting America. So we had on American Flight 11, we had a Sayeret Metcalf Special Operations Unit Hostage Rescue Specialist, Anti-Hijacking Specialist from Israel in row 9B. On United 175, we also had a lady sitting there who was an Israeli Defense Forces personnel working for Allied Materials, very involved with all of it. If you dig into Allied Materials, you'll be amazed what you find. And so she didn't make a phone call. We're not supposed to know she was there. So we're supposed to feel bad about that. But coincidentally, a coinkydink again, we had two Israeli specialists on the first two flights out of there. Now, this is the third flight. So we're going to take a look at some of the passengers. But some of the things that, first I want to talk about the phone calls, too, because I have the National Transportation Safety Board record here of this flight. And one of the things that I started doing as I was dissecting these phone calls and really getting into this from a flight attendant's viewpoint is that people were on aircraft, the National Transportation Board and the FAA are telling us are coming out of the sky 11 or 12,000 feet in a very short period of time, and yet they're on the phone and they never mention we're landing somewhere, okay? So I'm going to talk a little bit first off about Barbara Olson's phone calls. She was the passenger and one flight attendant named Renee May. Renee May called out at 9:12, and there is documentation that claims Barbara Olson started calling at the exact same minute, just like the other flights. They all started calling out at the exact same time. Now, I was always curious why on Flight 11 with so many flight attendants, only two of them made phone calls, and that was against protocol, too. I mean, why would you sit on the phone? If a hijacker really was on board and he saw a flight attendant sitting on the phone, he would kill him, and you would never do that. It's just against protocol. So these are the things I saw. Renee May, the flight attendant, called her mother and father in Las Vegas, Nevada, and she said, we've been hijacked. Well, she's like on reserve. They don't even know where she's at. and call American Airlines. Well, they also don't know what number to call, but if she could have picked up a phone, which she claimed, I mean, they claimed, the story claims that she did, called her mom and dad, that was not against protocol. You would call a secure number with the airline, crew scheduling, or some security number that will get you automatically, get you help in hijacking. You would never call your spouse or your parents or the bookkeeper or your accountant or your insurance dealer. I mean, you just wouldn't call anybody. We have things set in protocol. If all conversations would have been going through the pilots, if by chance they could have had some kind of phone call made, they would have called crew scheduling or a secure line with the company, period. End of story. They would never, ever, 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 ever call their spouse or their parents, because your parents wouldn't know what to do. They would call reservations, be put on hold for 20 minutes. By then, it's done. End of your story. So these are the things that I kept seeing that were not right with the story. Now, Barbara Olson, the original story is that she started calling out. She called either three or four times because Ted can't remember. But there's a lot of interesting things about Ted as well. Ted can't remember, but he did claim that Barbara called from her cell phone, because one account he gave actually says that Barbara called from a bathroom, and there are no air phones in the bathroom. But worse than that, as of the end of January 2001, American Airlines did not have any active air phones on their 757s. So she could not have been calling from an air phone. He tried to say that she called collect from her cell and then collect from an air phone, and then another account says she called from her cell phone in the bathroom of the airplane. Now, okay, at 9:12, the plane was at 27,000 feet. That's pretty good altitude, especially for cell phone coverage, huh? And so she calls in the weird things that she says. Now, she says that she's been herded to the back of the plane, that the hijackers have knives and box cutters, and the pilot has announced they've been hijacked. This is the only flight that anybody claimed that on.
So if the pilot announced that he had been hijacked, why didn't he squawk 7,500?
That's a good question. Okay, so we see an anomaly here. And then she asks her husband, an attorney, she asks her, what should she, a TV commentator, what should she tell the pilots to do? Now, I just went over this. The FAA tells us what to do, not Barbara Olson, not Ted Olson, not an attorney. We have step-by-step-by-step protocols, and the pilots would have squawked 7,500. And so you see the anomalies that you start to see as an airline professional. Even Ramjet saw that, and you never flew.
Well, I'm just thinking, okay, so you're in a hijacked situation and you've got a passenger, and it doesn't really matter who the passenger is or what their pedigree is. They're not going to take orders from a passenger.
Exactly.
So why in the world would she say, what should I tell them to do? Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, how in the heck would Ted know what to tell them to do?
Right.
I mean, all he is a solicitor general with a mustache. And even if he did have something important to say, what makes him think that he could communicate that to Barbara, who could then communicate that to the pilots, and that's how it would work?
Mm-hmm.
That is just, as they say in La La Land, that's crazy talk.
Yeah, it is. And so here's another thing that I found that's really interesting. According to the National Transportation Safety Board documents here, I've got a chart. And while Barbara was on the phone calls back and forth, and she called either three or four times, those calls were made between 9:12 a.m. and 9:27. The aircraft went from 27,000 feet down to 14,000 feet. That's just above that ding-dong, turn off your electronic devices. And you know how close you are. If you're flying into a city, say Seattle, Tacoma, you're looking at the Space Needle and downtown and the sports arenas and all of that stuff. So you can see how close you are to the ground. Now, that's not where she was. So when I started to see, I mean, you would say that. You would say, we're landing somewhere, and you'd be looking out the window to tell them what. Not what should I tell the pilots. Barbara Olson couldn't have told me as a flight attendant or a pilot anything of what to do. period. Because we and the pilots, flight attendants and the pilots, are trained every single year in a step-by-step protocol that had not changed since the late 60s, possibly early 70s. So, I mean, nothing had changed. So we know this protocol really well because we get drilled on it every single year. So when I started to see that, and people were asking me, and I started to realize that the public was really not believing Barbara Olson's story and Ted Olson's story. Now, 3 days after 9/11, Ted Olson was out there interviewing, and actually it was his birthday that day, and he was, that I believe that evening, had called in to CNN, I believe it was, and started to tell this crazy story of how she tried to call collect from her cell phone, collect from an airphone that wasn't on board the aircraft, and that she had trouble connecting because she was calling collect. Now, are we to believe that in 2001, when most of us had cell phones, that the attorney general or a solicitor general and a high-ranking attorney as he was did not have a cell phone and she didn't have a direct line to call him? She had to go through his secretaries or through a call collect. I mean, you can't call collect from a cell phone. So his lies started coming. So then I started to look at Ted Olson. And you know how I said earlier there was two passengers that I found very interesting, 9B on Flight 11, his hijack specialist. He was a Sayeret Metkal, a Mossad Israeli intelligence specialist, hijack coordinator, our anti-hijack coordinator, hostage rescue specialist, top dog, Jack Bauer of the Israeli Defense Forces Mossad, on board in 9B. The other flight, we had another Israeli Defense Forces lady. And so then I start to looking at Barbara Olson, and lo and behold, if her husband, Ted, who can't get his story straight, within a 72-hour period, he's told probably 15 different renditions of the phone call, that Ted Olson was the attorney for the Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. Oh, that's a coinky-dink. Okay, so I don't believe in coincidences anymore. Then I started to look at Barbara Olson and her background, and she spent a decade after she graduated from college. She went to Hollywood for a decade. Nobody knows what she did there. She could have been acting. She could have been an actress. She could have been doing commercials. We don't know. Because there is nothing publicly about what she did, period. Zero, nada. Now, after a decade in Hollywood, well, we know how conservative Hollywood is, don't we all? Don't we all how conservative they are? And how connected they are also to the Israeli Mossad, the CIA. She worked supposedly with Stacy Keach. Now, he has an interesting history. He got busted for drugs, I believe it was cocaine, going into London while she was working for him, supposedly. But he didn't really have something to do. But she was supposedly somehow connected with him through HBO. And there's lots of Mossad and CIA connections to Hollywood. We all know this because we just know it. If we're thinking people, we know this. So I found that really interesting that then she turns out after a decade in Hollywood and goes to Yeshiva University's law school. It's called the Ben Cordovan, I believe, law school at the Yeshiva University. Now, here's an interesting thing. Yeshiva University is in downtown Manhattan, New York City, and it's a Orthodox Jewish school. Interesting connect. Coinkydink again, isn't it? How does this keep happening? Now, I never dreamed this. I thought Arabs did this. I thought Saudis might have done it. I kept falling back into a connection into Israel through almost every single person that made a phone call and lots of the passengers that even some of them didn't make a phone call, but they were there. And so then I start looking at her and just her whole thing. When she gets out of law school, she goes to work for this law firm in Washington, D.C., Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. And they happen to have been White House counsels for Bill Clinton, President Jimmy Carter, Senior Bush. The law firm has had some really interesting people get involved prior to and after 9/11. Jamie Gorelick, who sat on the 9/11 commission, joined the law firm that Barbara Olson was with in 2003. So did, lo and behold, here's a coinkydink for you, the former FBI director Robert Mueller. Yeah, the FBI. Remember them? They're the ones that picked up the 80-some security cameras off the Pentagon and around circling the Pentagon, all the gas stations and hotels. Remember them? And sealed them up for the next 100 years? That FBI, that Robert Mueller. So I start looking at, well, this is really interesting that she's really involved with this law firm here. And then I'm finding this stuff on Wikipedia, so you don't have to go real deep, and you don't even have to be a brain surgeon or anything. I'm looking at this Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, and I see that their clients, lo and behold, here's a coincidence for you. Sit down on this one. In alphabetical order, at the top of the list is Akamai Technologies. Remember 9B, the guy that was the Israeli Defense Forces, Sayeret Metcalf Special Operations guy, Daniel Lewin, the hijack coordinator, the anti-hijacking specialist? Well, that's his company. He's the CEO and owner of Akamai Technologies. What are the chances that Barbara Olson's law firm is represents them? Well, small world. Well, the world gets even smaller. There was another company involved called Amdocs, and it's an Israeli company, lo and behold, that started off as an offshoot of something called the Golden Pages, which was an Israeli phone directory company, and they were working for almost all of the American United States phone companies doing billing. So what were they doing? They were monitoring every phone call made in the United States of America for a decade prior to 9/11. I bet you're wondering now, why didn't they hear any of these hijackers planning this, huh? I wonder why. So I'm starting to look at this, and I find another company. Well, would this be handy or not? Avid Technologies. This is another client from Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. Avid Technologies specializes in video and audio production technology. So in other words, since we just finished with the NFL season, I like to kind of explain this. When you look at the line of scrimmage and it's bright orange, or there's lines that are blue and there's logos for the teams with arrows showing which direction the ball is going in case you don't have your volume on, that's put on by what's called non-linear technology. And so you can add things to video live, and that technology was available at the time of 9/11. And some of the helicopter photographers and some of the people that have brought us videos happen to have been very well schooled in that and very accustomed to using live video editing. Think about that. Let this sink in for a minute. There was another company. Boeing was a contractor with a client of Wilmer Cutler and Pickering as well. And so were some other interesting places, Citicorp, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Goldman Sachs, HSBC Finance. If you looked into the Iran-Contra, some of these are going to sound familiar to you. The USB Bank, Enron, Building 7. They, yes, represented Enron. They also represented Ivan Boesky in insider trading. They also represented WorldCom, Building 7. They also represented, what are the chances? Remember the girl from the Israeli Defense Forces that was on Flight United 175? She worked for Applied Materials. They were also a client of Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. Barbara Olson's law firm that she worked for. Just some other ones that you will recognize and that you may or may not know that were involved with 9/11 and things that have happened and wars that have happened since then. GE, Monsanto, here's another one. We're going to talk about this guy next week. But Todd Beamer, Flight 93, let's roll. His company was Oracle. And lo and behold, Oracle is a client of Barbara Olson's law firm that she worked for, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering as well. So you see, we're seeing some interesting connections here. That's what I saw. I don't know what you're seeing, but I saw some interesting connections. So when you look at Barbara Olson, you have to look real closely at a lot of stuff surrounding her, where she went to school, what her husband's done. You got to look at Jonathan Pollard, who he was spying for. You got to see who was on Flight 11, 175. And then we're going to take a look at some more of these passengers here. So I don't want to run out of time, but there were some really interesting passengers on this airplane here too as well. Now, first off, let me just say this about Flight 77. It was a Boeing 757, if you're not familiar with that, and you're older, you might remember the Boeing 707. John F. Kennedy had one for Air Force One. It's a very similar sized aircraft, and I thought they flew very much alike because they were long, skinny, single-aisled aircraft, and they kind of fishtailed. Now, only a flight attendant could tell you that, because when you're in the back and you start to get in a little turbulence, it kind of fishtails. It's not easy to stand up in the back. So you could actually go up front or go to where the wings are, to the center point, and find it a lot easier to stand up. So work in the back galley. There was a back galley on the 707. It would be really bumpy sometimes back there if you got into the slightest bit of turbulence. Now, remember Flight 77. They're the plane that came into Washington, D.C., and we had Norman Mineta sitting in the bunker with Vice President Cheney, and they had some military kid coming in, so he was a Marine or something. Hold on a second, I have to take a sip. And he kept reporting, the plane is, 20 miles out, sir. The plane is 10 miles out, sir. Do your orders still stand? Norman Mineta, who was the Secretary of Transportation at the time of 9/11, he gave that testimony in the 9/11 hearings. He told that story. And the Vice President, Dick Cheney, said something to the effect of, have I changed my orders? No, the orders still stand. Has anybody changed it? No, he hasn't changed it, so... So Mineta says, well, he doesn't know what's going on because this kid keeps coming in. There's an airplane coming at the Pentagon, and it's, 10 miles out, 20 miles out, 30 miles out, and he's giving him some sort of countdown. Well, the interesting thing about Norm Mineta, well, I think this is kind of cute because one of the American flight attendants, Norm Mineta's wife flew for American. I think it was American. And one of the flight attendants that, when my first book came out, contacted me and was going to a... airline class reunion. So when we graduate and get our wings, we're all one class. And her classmate in her initial training was Norman Mineta's current wife. So she got a copy of Methodical Illusion. I thought that was kind of cool. Interesting. They haven't killed me yet. So anyway, Norman Mineta, I kind of thought, well, I wonder what he's doing now. That kind of inspired me to take a look at him. And, on 9/11, we have box cutters, knives, bombs, guns. Let's see, what else did we have on there? Oh, yeah, pepper spray and mace, or something else, as they said. These were all things that were illegal to bring through security. Security was run by Huntley, USA, and they are a subsidiary of ICTS, an Israeli company. Oh, did I say that again? How is it that I don't keep going into Saudi Arabia with these companies, but they stop in Israel? Well, another coinky-dink, I guess, that somehow we are led to believe that everyone at three major airports, Washington Dulles, Newark, and Boston's Logan, failed to do their job. And do you know, to this day, not one of those screeners that allowed guns, bombs, pepper spray, mace, or something else, box cutters and knives on board those aircraft have ever been disciplined. Huh. Interesting, huh? So, we have this company that failed America in security, failed to keep the passengers safe, failed to keep the people in the tower safe by allowing all this supposedly to happen, right? Well, where do you think Norman Mineta is sitting on the board of directors for right now? But if it isn't the ICTS International, the company that owns the subsidiary Huntley USA. Now, the interesting thing, you can look up Huntley USA and Norm Mineta. Huntley USA also does a security for a lot of places you're probably not going to be comfortable with. Nuclear power plants, nuclear weapon sites, worse. Yeah. Places where they make rocket fuel, jet fuel to propel rockets, companies like that, and they're all over stadiums, some, Huntley USA, and I think it's spelled H-U-N-T-L-E-I-G-H-U-S-A, and they're out there still, and they're still an Israeli-owned company, running security. And let's hope that we bust them before they allow another setup like 9/11 to happen. Because I found it very interesting that the Secretary of Transportation would join up with a company that failed Americans as bad as ICTS and Huntley USA did that day in security. So now I just want to move on to some of the other interesting people that were on this flight, Flight 77. There was a real high density count of passengers who worked at classified positions in the defense sector. Between 16 and 21 persons out of the total 58 supposed passengers were involved with defense contracting or weaponry, that sort of thing. Aerospace engineers, one of them was a gentleman named Mr. Yamnicki, and he was a longtime CIA operative that worked in a company called the Veridan Corporation as an aerospace engineer. Another passenger, Mr. Caswell, he led a team of about 100 scientists for the United States Navy. Others worked for Boeing, Raytheon from El Segundo, California, and worked on a project that was dubbed Black Hawk. You know, those black operations and their names. Kind of like DARPA's Operation Home Run, how they could take over. You remember, if you haven't looked this up, look up Operation Northwoods, because this was planned when Kennedy was still alive in the early 60s to remotely control and fake something very similar to 9/11 to get involved with Cuba in a conflict, the Bay of Pigs era. So the remote technology had been around. It had been around since the 70s. And DARPA, which is the research and development arm of the Department of Defense, they work hand in hand with another college that we keep finding. Every time we turn around with the 9/11 investigation, everything goes back to MIT. Not just did 9B Daniel Lewin go there, but MIT started the SAGE radar program. And by the way, the NORAD and the FAA that claimed they couldn't see each other's radar and they couldn't see the same things on radar that day, well, they're connected, so there's no reason they couldn't, other than the fact that someone was in there through a back door in their software, making it so they couldn't see what was going on. But we had some really interesting people here. This William Caswell, born in Boston, Massachusetts, was a third-generation physicist, who worked for the United States Navy, and his whole family was involved with that kind of stuff. Then we had Stanley Hall. He was from Raytheon Electronic Warfare Development Department. And he'd been around a long time. He was 68. He knew a lot about electronic warfare. There were some of these guys from Raytheon also on American Flight 11. Let's see, who else might be kind of interesting. There was a guy named Brian Jack, who was responsible for crunching America's defense budget. Now, you'll remember, right before 9/11, the Pentagon was crying for money. Remember that? They were crying for money, and right before that, on September 10th, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had announced on television to the world that they were investigating losing a $2.3 trillion in the Pentagon budget. So here we got the main budget cruncher here on supposedly on Flight 77. Coincidentally, I guess. A quinky-dink. And let's see, what else do we have? We had some propulsion technology engineer specialists that worked with Boeing satellite systems.
You know, I don't necessarily find any of these people, you know, out of the ordinary. I think on typical transcontinental flights, you're going to find a certain element of that. What I do find interesting is the concentration of them and also the correlation between that and the kinds of engineers that were on MH370.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
As in, if you want to get these people off, you know, the scenario that Rebecca has painted in Methodical Illusion, allows for them to be removed. And I suspect that the same thing happened with Flight 370. Anybody or anything that was on that airplane could easily have been removed because nobody, quote, unquote, everyone would think knows you were where
dead.
It went.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone would think you're dead. So if you were, and you know, I've said this before in other shows. I was a big fan of the Fox show 24 with Jack Bauer. And what really happened to me was watching through, I have all the discs, watching through one day, it dawned on me that through all of those 9 seasons, they tell you how they did 9/11. They tell you about the override system. They tell you about how they've got the ability to speak to pilots or pilots, faked pilots, speaking to air traffic controllers and completely fake it from a distance. And I have found that there were people involved with this that were involved with the ACAR system, the radio, Rockwell Collins, Raytheon. Now, interesting thing about Raytheon, Raytheon is really... they're the main defense contractor and the pillar of the Global Hawk remote control technologies. Did you hear what I just said? Remote control technologies. So when you see stuff like this, and for me what I started doing is I just started taking notes. I have a pretty good memory for stuff, but I started taking notes and I was like, Wait a minute. We're talking Rockwell Collins. Here's a coinkydink for you. Remember Betty Ong called in to something a flight attendant would never do. She called into a reservations line. And that gal that was on the reservations line, there was actually 3 agents that eventually came on, a security person, a supervisor, and the agent that picked up the initial call. They have a big red button, and that button is their emergency button that's supposed to tape record every minute of that call, no matter how long it is. Rockwell Collins had just gone and redone their systems. And so on 9/11, when Betty Ong made the mistake, no flight attendant would, and called the reservations line, that happened to get right through to someone. When that gal pressed the red button, only 4.5 minutes of a 27-minute phone call were recorded. How coincidental. And how helpful, because they could basically go in there. Now, I've been contacted by people that worked for... in reservations for American and in their operations center. And the FBI was there immediately. And they absolutely took total control. And they told the people their story, which I found really interesting. Because we don't have a tape recorder of Betty Ong's call, but 4.5 minutes. And anything you listen to on YouTube, they more than likely edited and left things out. Like I talked about when we talked about American's Flight 11 and Betty Ong's phone calls. She said things in the initial FBI. I found all, I probably four renditions of the FBI's transcript of her phone call. And one of the things I found really interesting is that some of them left out these words. He stood upstairs. Now it's in the initial interview taken on 9/11, early in the morning before noon.
Well, you know, if you want to talk about leaving things out, you know, all of Barbara Olson's comments and phone calls and everything that she portrayed that really painted the picture for the public and lent certitude to the whole 9/11 story was left out of the Massawi trial. I mean, as far as the Massawi trial was concerned, Barbara Olson didn't even exist. And the reason they couldn't put that in there is it would have refuted what it was that was being presented in the trial.
That's true. And I believe, if I remember correctly, that the 9/11 Commission completely ignored not just Building 7, but Barbara Olson's phone calls as well. Because if they had to, if she called from a cell phone, if she called from an airphone, well, the plane didn't have them. They'd all been deactivated by January of 2001 on the aircraft she was on, the 757 for American Airlines. They didn't have them. So we know it couldn't have been that. So you couldn't have produced a GTE or a Verizon phone bill from the phone because there were no phones on the plane. And you couldn't produce her cell phone bill through Ted Olson because she didn't call from her cell phone. And if she did, she wasn't at 27,000 feet. And so where was she? That's what I started to look at because, repeat this again, cell phones still to this day, unless you're on a specially equipped aircraft. In 2001, you couldn't get any cell reception for a text or a call above depending upon the city and how fast you were going, if you were coming in to descend or if you were leaving, or 1,500 feet, maybe 1,800 feet, maybe as high as 2,000 for a very, very short period of time. But so when I started to see this, knowing what I knew about airplanes and cell phones and airphones, I was like, uh-oh. So when I started putting all this together, and I realized that these planes were taken over, and really it was the flight attendant Betty Ong, and when she said, "We're up in the air, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked," and I went, uh-oh. Then if she doesn't know, then they're not being typically hijacked. There's no hijacker making demands. And that was another thing, that the flight attendants that did call out never gave the right kind of information that we were taught and told to do. And I'm not going to go into those, but let me just tell you this, that there were step-by-step protocols for us to follow and specific details we would say. And where you're sitting in your jump seat was not one of them. Phoning your spouse or your parents was also not something you should do.
Now, in the time we have left, let's just kind of wrap up this Flight 77 and the fact that using just YouTube videos, we know that there was no airplane that hit the Pentagon. We have eyewitnesses that we have actually communicated with that were on the ground at the Pentagon helping to remove dead bodies, because there were a lot of them that were as a result of the explosions that happened. And they claim there were no airplane or airplane parts. The nonsense that you see coming out of various YouTubes about airplane parts aren't correlated to 757s.
Well, if you've read Methodical Illusion, there's a character in there that Vera Hansen meets and has a conversation with who was at the Pentagon. That person is real. I changed his name. The conversation I truly did have with him, he was there. The people, coincidentally, where the missile that hit the Pentagon hit, it hit the two offices that were investigating the missing $2.3 trillion. And the comptroller of the Pentagon at that time, Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Rabbi Dov Zakheim was the CEO of the SPC Corporation that created and used and still to this day sells the flight termination remote control system that was used on the aircraft on 9/11, that is still to this day used on our drones around the world. They make the control units, they make mobile control units, and they make the plug-in device for the Boeing flight computer that is called the flight termination system. Now, one more thing about the good Rabbi Dov Zakheim, just so you know, SPC Corporation that he was the CEO of, had a subsidiary company called TriData, and TriData was a company that was given several of the contracts after the FBI bombing of the World Trade Center tower in 1993. That is the only company, besides the original architects, to ever have, as best I can find out, the blueprints for both towers, the World Trade Center towers. So we got this good Rabbi Dov Zakheim, who is a dual citizen with Israel, not Saudi Arabia, coincidentally, who has misplaced $2.3 trillion. Gee, that would make a handy payoff for 9B and some of those others, wouldn't it? $2.3 trillion, digest how much money that is. It's gone. It went somewhere. Somebody got it. Somebody got a good payoff. Somebody did. And after 9/11 hit, the budget went skyrocketing at the Pentagon. And no one ever asked again what happened to the missing, misplaced $2.3 trillion that the good Rabbi Dov Zakheim had misplaced, ever.
Well, back to the airplane, Flight 77. We know that didn't hit the Pentagon. Rebecca has revealed where it went to. But just a little foreshadowing of the new book that she's working on. She figured out what did hit the Pentagon and from where it was launched.
And, you know, Flight 77 claimed that it came out of the sky at a 270-degree corkscrew turn and landed without the jet scraping the grass, without any wheels down, which is impossible for a 757, and went through a little tiny section on the ground level of the Pentagon. A great video Barbara Honegger has out called, I think it's called Behind the Smoke Curtain, and you can find it on YouTube. I highly suggest you spend the 3 hours and take a listen, because the two offices were the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Army Auditors were not close to each other. Both of them were pretty well bombed out, and most of the investigators died. There's just a couple, I know of one actually, but just a couple of them that weren't there or weren't quite at the office yet made it through. And so you see, it does no good at all for a terrorist from Afghanistan to destroy an investigation into the missing $2.3 trillion, now does it? And how would they know which offices in the United States Pentagon were actually doing the investigation? Looks like an inside job, because, one, it doesn't benefit terrorists to hit that those two offices, and you cannot buy that was a coincidence, because there's just way too many of them. We just talked about the coincidence just around Barbara Olson. My goodness sakes, you can't have that many coincidences. That 9B, the hijacked specialist Akamai Technologies company, was a client of Barbara Olson's law firm she was working for, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. Come on, that's ridiculous. So slap yourself if you still think it's a coincidence, because there are no coincidences, but people are being busted because people are now starting to look at this and look closely. Now, I'm not the only person with eyes to see, but for some reason, this stuff just jumps out at me. And it did that once I realized that what the planes were doing when they were coming out of the sky, 6 to 10,000 feet a minute, you have three or four people on the phone on Flight 93, we're going to talk about next week, and no one ever mentions a rapid descent, and it's a frightening descent to come out of the sky that fast. It's scary as hell, and it would be really hard to even be talking on a phone, any kind of phone, coming out fighting G-forces like that. No flight attendants are walking in the aisle, trust me, and passengers are either strapped in real tight or they're strapped onto the ceiling the G-force is holding them up there. So I started to see that, and I put the National Transportation Safety Board. Now, I studied crashes every year. That's one of the things we did. We studied crashes so that we know what happens. I've used this before. The old DC-10, I don't even know that anybody's flying them. The old DC-10 had a big, huge engine on the tail up high. And so when it would crash, oftentimes near the back at door 5 in the back, it would crack. The fuselage would crack, and then the big tail section would fall back, and the doors wouldn't open, but you'd get out the crack. So we would study crashes to find out how to get our passengers off the aircraft and hopefully keep everybody alive. That's what we did. So when I wasn't unfamiliar with plane crashes, but when I saw the Pentagon and I heard Jamie McIntosh say no airplane crash here, I went, yep, that's right. Wonder what blew it up. Something like a bomb, perhaps. But also Shanksville, and we're going to talk about that next week. There was no plane crash at Shanksville, period. That you can't take an aircraft that size, that much luggage, and you have to understand, not only was there tons of fuel on board, but there's cargo, not just your suitcases, but there's boxes by Amazon, by UPS, FedEx, U.S. Mail. There's frozen lobsters. There's fruits and vegetables. There's all kinds of stuff in cargo, and those planes come out full of cargo. It's not wasted space. If there's only 50 passengers or 30 passengers, don't think that the mail didn't get on or the cargo isn't in there, because it is. And so there was lots of stuff that would have shown up.
And they're shipped in big containers, and those containers just don't disappear and they don't disintegrate.
No, and so you can look at, just Google search some crashes and see what a real crash looks like. We're going to go into Shanksville in depth next week on Flight 93. And we may have to actually do that in two shows, because there were so many phone calls and so many anomalies, like Todd Beamer's phone going on for hours later after the crash. So.
Well, we're just about out of time. Generally, we go roust Frank out of the bar, but for those of you who don't know, Frank Sinatra Jr. passed away this week, and so we're going to leave Frank wherever he is.
Talk to the end.
At the bar or wherever, and we're just going to talk till time runs out, which is not very long.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, listen, if you haven't read our books, Methodical Illusion was the first one, Methodical Deception the second. The third one is coming along. I'm a little behind writing, just because I've been really sick with the pneumonia, but that'll be out soon. And we thank you for joining us, and we hope you come on next week for Flight 93's phone calls.
Ooh, that'll be fun.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Bye-bye.